I once mentioned in passing on a live stream that I am against antitrust laws, what Americans call antitrust. And one of the questions I get asked a lot is why. In this video, I'm going to lay out my reasons, but before doing so, let me name some of the studies that helped me form this view. First, there's Milton Friedman, who weirdly, in Capitalism and Freedom, is quite muted about coming out against antitrust, but does talk about the various forms of monopoly. But since then, in many talks in the 70s and the 80s, he was more vocal about his disdain for antitrust. Then there's Friedman's old Sith apprentice, Thomas Sowell, who, in The Quest for Cosmic Justice and elsewhere, highlights a lot of the problems with antitrust law as it has been written and legislated. Another key essay is Lawrence W. Reed's Witch Hunting for Robber Barons, The Standard Oil Story, from March 1980, which is reproduced in the book Excuse Me, Professor, which is generally an excellent collection of essays slaying the myths of progressivism. There's also a version of that essay online, which I'll link in the show notes. Reed uses two sources. The first is Dominic T. Armentato's book, The Myths of Antitrust, from 1972, which was reprinted in 1993 as Antitrust and Monopoly, Anatomy of Policy Failure. The second is John S. McGee's essay in the Journal of Law and Economics, Predatory Price Cutting, The Standard Oil Case, from 1958. In addition to all of this, Murray N. Rothbard's book, The Progressive Era, has tons of information about various attempts at monopolies in American history. He's got a few great lectures on this on YouTube also, which I'll link for further exploration. Now, the reason for this longer than usual scholarly preamble is that while everything I'm about to say is based on real-world data, for clarity and for understanding, and to avoid getting bogged down in the specifics of these real-world cases, I'm going to be using a fictional scenario to explain my position on antitrust. Because today, kids, we're going to be focusing on the market for Chemical X.
Chemical X.
Now, it does not really matter what this product is. All that matters is that there's a market for it and that people want it and buy it. Let's meet some of the players in the market. So there are four key players in the Chemical X market. At the top, we have Dastardly Inc. On the right, the Pit Stop Corporation. On the bottom, the Slag Brothers. And on the left, Pending Industries. Now, as things stand, each of these charges $3 per barrel of Chemical X and has exactly 25% market share. But there are a couple more elements to this little market we need to add. Of course, there must be a government, and I've represented that by old Tricky Dicky here. What else? Well, what town would be complete without a criminal element? And so here are the Mafia, represented ably by the Anthill Mob. Now, as Milton Friedman notes in Capitalism and Freedom, when you boil it down, there are only really three types of monopoly. The first is what economists call an efficiency monopoly. Now, these are relatively rare, but it's when one company does things so well, that is, so efficiently, that it ends up pushing out the other competitors because customers, for whatever reason, prefer that company's product to everyone else's. Here you can see Professor Pat Pending, perhaps using his superior knowledge of science, has managed to produce his Chemical X for only $2.50 a barrel, and this has put a squeeze on the other three, giving Pending a 90% market share. Eventually, he drives the others out and secures a monopoly in Chemical X. This is the purest form of the efficiency monopoly, but to my knowledge, there aren't any in history that have reached 100% market share. If anyone watching this can cite examples of a pure 100% efficiency monopoly in real history, I'd love to see it, because these sorts of things fascinate me. Now, I will return to the case of the efficiency monopoly in due course, because there is much more to say here as it pertains to antitrust law. But let's run through the other two types of monopoly first. The second type of monopoly is collusion. If you look at the current screen, here all four competitors, seeing that they are doing really well, have agreed among themselves to jack up the price per barrel to $5 and to fix it there. Effectively, they have formed a cartel. Now, at various times in history, competitors in certain industries have tried this on, most famously the so-called robber barons in the late 19th century in the USA. Now, you'd think that this was a good plan, right? But in practice, these types of cartels seldom last for long. Why? Well, for a start, each of the firms have to start investing in expensive administration and bureaucracy to enforce the price fix. Each company is wary and distrustful that one of the other companies is going to break ranks and rein on their agreement. Incidentally, in Europe, and Friedman mentions this in his book, if companies come together to collude like this and make an agreement of a price fix, they can actually take that to court and get it ratified by government so that someone cannot break the cartel. This is one reason why Europe historically has suffered more from this sort of thing than America. I believe this was the situation in the European truck industry for decades. But anyway, after a couple of years, someone will break ranks. Oh, look. Here, Dick Dastardly couldn't take it anymore, and he slashed his price to $2, screwing over the rest of the cartel and stealing 90% of the market share. Now the others have a choice. They can either try to force Dastardly to stick his prices back up, maybe that's where the mafia might come in, or they can drop their prices too. If they don't, Dastardly will put them out of business, and that serves them right for trying to cheat the market in the first place. But let's pretend Dastardly didn't break the ranks. What would happen? Well, in the absence of any regulations putting artificial entry barriers on new competitors, we'd simply get a new startup brave enough to take on the cartel. Oh, here's Peter Perfect with the perfect price. And of course, immediately he steals all the customers. Now again, the four original competitors can either try to hire the mafia to kill Peter Perfect, or they have to drop their own prices, or they're going to go broke. This is actually what happened to the robber baron cartel when Jay Gould, someone who Murray N. Rothbard thinks is a genuine hero of capitalism, essentially did exactly what Peter Perfect did here. He was called a traitor and a rape buster by the owners of the cartel, but the real winners here were the customers who got to pay less for exactly the same rail journeys. So now the third type of monopoly, and I should say, according to the aforementioned Murray Rothbard, this is the only type of real monopoly, and that's the coercive monopoly. Here you can see that Dick Dastardly has gone to President Nixon and managed to secure himself an exclusive license to sell Chemical X. Of course, this immediately gives him a 100% market share because now the other three companies are operating illegally and have to shut down. Virtually all real-life monopolies, for example the yellow taxis of New York or the black cabs of London, or for many years the US Postal Service or the Royal Mail, and basically any other monopoly you can care to name, exists under some arrangement like this, where one organisation is getting preferential treatment from the government by making it illegal for anyone else to compete with them. Now this always leads to a number of things. First, it leads to higher prices. Of course, now Dastardly Inc. are the only game in town, so why wouldn't they hike the price up? Second, it leads to a drop-off in quality because the monopoly organisation becomes complacent. Third, as real demands from people slowly rise, black market services, perhaps provided by the mafia, start to fill the void. Incidentally, I mentioned the New York cabs there. In Walter Block's Defending the Undefendable, the chapter on the gypsy cab drivers, which I've linked in the show notes, is a fascinating portrait of how this works in the real world. And of course, as Dastardly keeps pushing his luck and sneaking that price back up, the more the mafia is going to fill the hole, until in the end, Dastardly is just milking his existing customers for everything they've got, while the mafia are taking more and more of the market share. Of course, eventually, he'll put in a call to old Slick Rick, and maybe he'll get the FBI to bust down on the mafia, and a front page story out of it too. Nixon was the law and order president, after all. Now you'll note that at no time during my discussion of the three types of monopoly did I utter the phrase predatory pricing, which is an entirely hypothetical scenario that for some reason underpins antitrust law, and in the vast majority of cases has been the ostensible rationale for taking companies to court in the first place. Indeed, in recent memory, the black cab drivers have frequently accused Uber of predatory pricing. But what on earth does this mean? This is the ingenious sounding but actually economically illiterate plan of pushing one's prices to rock bottom, even taking a loss, as dastardly as done here, in order to push the competition out. And then, once they are all out of business, jack up prices sky high and laugh all the way to the bank as customers no longer have any choice but to spend with you. Now, as Thomas Sowell points out in Basic Economics, this is plain stupid as a plan. Even if you think about it for more than just 1 second, it starts to fall apart. For starters, predatory pricing pays off only if the surviving predator can raise the prices enough to recover the previous losses, making enough extra profit thereafter to justify the risks. And these risks are not small. The most obvious risk is that the targeted competitor will survive, leaving the would-be predator with nothing but red ink for his trouble. However, even the demise of a competitor does not leave the survivor home free. Bankruptcy does not by itself destroy the fallen competitor's physical plant or the people whose skills made it a viable business. Both may now be available, perhaps at distressed prices, to others who can spring up to take the defunct firm's place. In other words, here comes Peter Perfect again with his $2 barrels of Chemical X. Now, Dastardly is forced back to charging $2 lest he faces bankruptcy himself. So now he has to compete again, and he's already put himself in the red after all those months and possibly years of selling at $1 a barrel to push all of the others out. Now, here's the kicker. We, as the customer, during all of this time, are laughing. We got $1 Chemical X while Dastardly was trying his stupid Wile E. Coyote-style scheme, and now we get $2 barrels from Peter Perfect, or from Dastardly if he chooses to compete. Of course, if he doesn't, he's going to go bust because nobody is going to buy at $8 when Perfect is selling for $2. No matter what here, the customer wins. So the very idea on which antitrust law is based in the first place, that is, a plan so stupid, to my knowledge, no one has ever managed to actually pull it off, is entirely imaginary. Again, if you can actually name some real examples of this happening and working and going exactly to plan, show me. I'd be interested to see them. And remember, this has to happen with zero government involvement. So now, given all this outline, I want to look at the sort of scenario in which antitrust laws have actually been brought to bear in the real world. But to do this, I'm going to need to complicate our little market for a moment. We need to consider some more factors. That is, when customers are making decisions in the Chemical X market, they aren't just looking at price. They are also considering the quality of the product. Also, from the point of view of the economy as a whole, we also need to consider the total number of barrels of Chemical X. Now, I have no idea what this product actually does, but let's pretend for the purposes of this scenario that the more Chemical X we have, the better, and the less we have, the worse. So we have a magic triangle, and in the ultimate ideal scenario, we want the highest possible quality of Chemical X in the highest possible quantities for the lowest possible price. So a Chemical X industry doing really well would give us all three of these things. Now, let's go back to our original scenario where everyone has 25% share for $3. Let's just say each company has a production capacity of 100 units and the quality of the product is 7. But then, using his skills of science after years of investing in R&D, Professor Pending somehow manages to invent a machine that pumps out 9,000 units of Chemical X at only $2 a barrel. Pretty good, huh? Now, the Slag brothers, they've managed to somehow perfect the formula and they've upped the quality to 9, but they can only make 500 units and turn a profit at a price point of $5. Dastardly and Pitstop, meanwhile, well, they're struggling. Maybe they didn't really invest in R&D that much, over the same time period and spent their revenues on other things. So one of the interesting things here is that you'll see that by virtue of the fact that Pending is now pumping out 9,000 units, he's automatically taking 90% of the market share. But if you look at the other three firms on their own terms, they've actually grown. Dastardly by 200%, Pitstop by 100%, and the Slag Brothers by 400%. So a look at their balance sheets would see them all making pretty good profits and growth measured against their own previous performance. But Pending's astronomical growth makes it look like they are doing really badly in comparison. And of course, in absolute terms, that would be true, because Pending is now making a hell of a lot more money than all of the others put together. And so Pending, wishing to improve his product even more, might want to think about buying some of these smaller rivals. Dastardly and Pitstop, if nothing else, would give him an extra 500 units of production. The Slag Brothers, meanwhile, represent some real value because their formula for Chemical X is actually superior to Pending's. If only Pending could combine what he knows, that is, his mass economy of scale production, with what they know, that is, the superior formula, maybe they could market that superior product on a massive scale. Now you'll note that as things stand, 10,000 barrels of Chemical X are being shipped. The average price is $2.15, and the average quality is 8.03. What would happen if Pending could buy up these competitors? Well, let's assume that the Slag Brothers formula is scalable, and they can keep that price at $2 per barrel because of their extra production capacity. And you can see that even operating by this point as a monopoly, we've managed to max out most of the magic triangle here. High total number of barrels, high quality, low price. I mean, it's ticking every box. But of course, in the real world, this has seldom been allowed to happen, since the so-called progressives in the first decade of the 20th century invented antitrust laws. So in the scenario I just outlined, probably Tricky Dicky steps in and stops these mergers from happening. Pending Industries, it will be argued, despite having grown the Chemical X industry to what it is today, should not be allowed to take over that industry, even if it can produce more barrels at lower prices. And the government says it does this in the name of competition, for competition's sake. But you have to remember, the only reason that competition is good is because it makes prices lower and production methods better. In this case, it really would be better if Pending was managing the Slag Brothers factories. Anyway, that's one scenario. Another scenario is that Dastardly Pitstop and the Slag Brothers complain about Pending to the government. They lobby the government, saying that Pending is guilty of predatory pricing. And not only that, the Slag Brothers quickly go to the press to get the media and the public on their side. Let's have a look at that front page, shall we? Chemical X magnate's greed knows no bounds. No fewer than 97% of leading industry experts have condemned the predatory pricing practices of market-leading Chemical X firm Pending Industries. Critics have accused Pending Industries of anti-competitive and unfair pricing strategies in a bid to achieve total domination of the Chemical X market. Rock Slag, co-founder of Slag Brothers, a rival Chemical X firm, which has been struggling in recent years, was quoted as saying, "It's a disgrace. We have worked for many years to get the very best Chemical X products out to our customers. The ruthlessness of predatory sharks like Pending Industries knows no bounds. They are trying to put us and every other business trying to earn an honest living out of business. It is not fair." CEO Professor Pat Pending was unavailable for comment. And so the reputational damage here is done. By this point, there's a big public outcry against the practices of Pending Industries. Students are protesting outside their factories. University intellectuals are waxing lyrical about the evils of the exploitative Chemical X industry and their greedy industry heads, as embodied by Professor Pat Pending. It has become rather vogue, let us say, to be seen frothing at the mouth in sheer rage at Pending Industries. And so, of course, with an election round the corner, the government is only too happy to endorse the lobby's request to take Pending Industries to court on the charge of antitrust practices. And what's the outcome of all of this? Well, Pending Industries have suffered massive damages to reputation, severe fines and so on, so now have massively reduced capacity to produce Chemical X and their market share. Remember, in a market that is only as big as it is because of them in the first place, is now reduced to only 35%. The Slag brothers still can't work out how to scale up their superior product and so are stuck with a high-end price point. And Dastardly and Pitstop are just kind of trundling along. So now we have fewer units being sold at more expensive price points and at a lower quality. Let's just compare the numbers. And of course, another upshot of all of this is that through their lobbying, Pitstop, Dastardly and the Slag brothers have managed to convince the government to introduce new regulations, effectively making it harder for startups to enter the industry. So our old friend Peter Perfect is denied entry because the barriers are now too high to overcome. He's been locked out by the government. And since we know this is a market that can sustain 10,000 barrels of Chemical X as opposed to only 7,000, that is, we know that the potential is there, look at that. The mafia have got back into the game, as now there's a healthy black market brewing too. And if you're wondering, yes, the vast majority of this scenario is based on the real-life case of John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil, where more or less exactly this happened in a very famous antitrust case. And so, for all these reasons, I am against antitrust laws because they usually end up doing exactly the opposite of what they were intended for, and the customer ends up with smaller numbers of a worse product for a higher price. Till next time.
I'd like to thank Son of Tiamat, The Crimson Satyr, Charles Vinson, Edward Darra, Graham Leggett, Michael Burt, Slaughter Otter, Ginger Bill, and Blake Barrows.